I'm just looking forward to being done with it. Tedious business. I anticipate a dull meeting. Dull meeting, my ass. Not after you walk straight up to the lady with the brass bloody hand and say, "Excuse me, madam, but..." 2. "I have been cheating," said Locke. "Steadily. At every single game I've played since my partner and I first came to the Sinspire 2 years ago." Receiving a piercing stare from Selendry was a curious thing. Her left eye was nothing but a dark hollow, half covered with a translucent awning that had once been a lid. Her single good eye did the work of two, and damned if it wasn't unnerving. "Are you deaf, madam? Every single one. Cheating. All the way up and down this precious Sinspire, cheating floor after floor, taking your other guests for a very merry ride."
"I wonder," she said in her slow, witchy whisper, "if you truly understand what it means to say that to me, Master Costa. Are you drunk?"
"I'm as sober as a suckling infant."
"Is this something you've been put up to?"
"I am completely serious," said Locke, "and it's your master I would speak to about my motivations, privately." The sixth floor of the Sinspire was quiet. Locke and Selendry were alone, with four of Requin's uniformed attendants waiting about 20 feet away. It was still too early in the evening for this level's rarefied crowd to have finished their slow, carousing migration up through the livelier levels. At the heart of the sixth floor was a tall sculpture within a cylinder of transparent elderglass. Though the glass could not be worked by human arts, there were literally millions of cast-off fragments and shaped pieces scattered around the world, some of which could be conveniently fitted to human use. There were elderglass scavenging guilds in several cities, capable of filling special needs in exchange for exorbitant fees. Within the cylinder was something Locke could only describe as a copperfall. It was a sculpture of a rocky waterfall, taller than a man, in which the rocks were shaped entirely from silver Valani coins, and the water was a constant heavy stream of copper centira, thousands upon thousands of them. The clatter within the soundproof glass enclosure must have been tremendous, but for those on the outside the show proceeded in absolute silence. Some mechanism in the floor was catching the stream of coins and recirculating it up the back of the silver rocks. It was eccentric and hypnotic. Locke had never before known anyone to decorate a room with a literal pile of money.
"Master? You presume that I have one?"
"You know I mean Requin."
"He would be the first to correct your presumption violently."
"A private audience would give us a chance to clear up several misunderstandings, then."
"Oh, Requin will certainly speak to you very privately."
Selendry snapped the fingers of her right hand twice, and the four attendants converged on Locke. Selendry pointed up. Two of them took firm hold of his arms, and together they began to lead him up the stairs. Selendry followed a few steps behind. The seventh floor was dominated by another sculpture within an even wider elderglass enclosure. This one seemed to be a circle of volcanic islands, again built from silver Volani, floating in a sea of solid gold solari. Each of the silver peaks had a stream of gold coins bubbling from its top to fall back down into the churning, gleaming ocean. Requin's guards maintained a pace too vigorous for Locke to catch many more details of the sculpture or the room. They passed another pair of uniformed attendants beside the stairwell and continued up. At the heart of the eighth floor was a third spectacle within glass, the largest yet. Locke blinked several times and suppressed an appreciative chuckle. It was a stylized sculpture of Tal Verar, silver islands nestled in a sea of gold coins. Standing over the model city, bestriding it like a god, was a life-sized marble sculpture of a man Locke recognized immediately. The statue, like the man, had prominent curving cheekbones that lent the narrow face a sense of mirth, plus a round protruding chin, wide eyes and large ears that seemed to have been jammed into the head at right angles. Requin, whose features bore a fair resemblance to a marionette put together in haste by a somewhat irate puppeteer. The statue's hands were held outward at the waist, spread forward, and from the flaring stone cuffs around them, two solid streams of gold coins were continually gushing onto the city below. Locke, staring, only avoided tripping over his own feet because the attendants holding him chose that moment to tighten their grip. Atop the eighth-floor stairs was a pair of lacquered wooden doors. Selendri strode past Locke and the attendants. To the left of the door was a small silver panel in the wall. Selendri slid her brass hand into it, let it settle into some sort of mechanism, and then gave it a half-turn to the left. There was a clatter of clockwork devices within the wall, and the doors cracked open.
"Search him,"
she said, as she vanished through the doors without turning around. Locke was rapidly stripped of his coat. He was then poked, prodded, sifted, and patted down more thoroughly than he'd been during his last visit to a brothel. His sleeve stiletto, a perfectly ordinary thing for a man of consequence to carry, was confiscated. His purse was shaken out, his shoes were slipped off, and one attendant even ran his hands through Locke's hair. When this process was finished, Locke, shoeless, coatless, and somewhat dishevelled, was given a less than gentle shove toward the doors Selendri had vanished through. Past them was a dark space not much larger than a wardrobe closet. A winding black iron staircase, wide enough for one person, rose up from the floor toward a square of soft yellow light. Locke padded up the stairs and emerged into Requin's office. This place took up the whole of the ninth floor of the Sin Spire, an area against the far wall, curtained off with silk drapes, probably served as a bedroom. There was a balcony door on the right-hand wall, covered by a sliding mesh screen. Locke could see a wide, darkened sweep of Tal Varrar through it, so he presumed it looked east. Every other wall of the office, as he'd heard, was liberally decorated with oil paintings, nearly 20 of them around the visible periphery of the room, in elaborate frames of gilded wood, masterworks of the late Therin throne years, when nearly every noble at the Emperor's court had kept a painter or sculptor on the leash of patronage, showing them off like pets. Locke hadn't the training to tell one from another by sight, but rumour had it that there were two Morestras and a Ventathis on Requin's walls. Those two artists, along with all their sketches, books of theory and apprentices, had died centuries before, in the firestorm that had consumed the imperial city of Therim Pell. Selendri stood beside a wide wooden desk the colour of a fine coffee, cluttered with books and papers and miniature clockwork devices. A chair was pushed out behind it, and Locke could see the remnants of a dinner, some sort of fish on a white iron plate, paired with a half-empty bottle of pale golden wine. Selendri touched her flesh hand to her brass simulacrum, and there was a clicking noise. The hand folded apart like the petals of a gleaming flower. The fingers locked into place along the wrist and revealed a pair of blackened steel blades, 6 inches long, previously concealed at the heart of the hand. Selendri waved these like a claw and gestured for Locke to stand before the desk, facing it.
"Master Custer."
The voice came from somewhere behind him, within the silk-curtained enclosure.
"What a pleasure. Selendri tells me you've expressed an interest in getting killed."
"Hardly, sir. All I told your assistant was that I had been cheating steadily, along with my partner, at the games we've been playing in your Sin Spire, for nearly the last 2 years."
"Every game," said Selendri. "You said every single game."
"Ah, well," said Locke with a shrug. "It just sounded more dramatic that way. It was more like nearly every game."
"This man is a clown,"
whispered Celendri. Oh, no, said Locke. Well, maybe occasionally, but not now. Locke heard footsteps moving toward his back across the room's hardwood floor.
You're here on a bet, said Requin, much closer.
Not in the way that you mean, no.
Requin stepped around Locke and stood before him, hands behind his back, peering at Locke very intently. The man was a virtual twin of his statue on the floor below, perhaps a few pounds heavier, with the bristling curls of steel-grey hair atop his head receding more sharply. His narrow frock coat was crushed black velvet, and his hands were covered with brown leather gloves. He wore optics, and Locke was surprised to see that the glimmer he had taken for reflected light the night before was actually imbued within the glass. They glowed a translucent orange, giving a demonic cast to the wide eyes behind them. Some fresh, expensive alchemy Locke had never heard of, no doubt.
Did you drink anything unusual tonight, Master Costa? An unfamiliar wine, perhaps?
Unless the water of Tal Verar itself intoxicates, I'm as dry as baked sand.
Requin moved behind his desk, picked up a small silver fork, speared a white morsel of fish, and pointed at Locke with it.
So, if I'm to believe you, you've been successfully cheating here for 2 years, and aside from the sheer impossibility of that claim, now you just want to give yourself up to me. Case of conscience?
Not even remotely.
An earnest wish for an elaborate suicide?
I aim to leave this office alive.
Oh, you wouldn't necessarily be dead until you hit the cobblestones 9 stories below.
Perhaps I can convince you I'm worth more to you intact.
Requin chewed his fish before speaking again.
Just how have you been cheating, Master Costa?
Fast fingers work, mostly.
Really? I can tell a card sharp's fingers at a glance. Let's see that right hand of yours.
Requin held out his gloved left hand, and Locke hesitantly put his own forward, as though they might shake.
Requin snatched Locke's right hand above the wrist and slammed it down atop his desk, but rather than the sharp rap Locke expected, his hand tipped aside some sort of disguised panel and slid into an aperture just beneath the surface of the desk. There was a loud clack of clockwork, and a cold pressure pinched his wrist. Locke jerked back, but the desk had swallowed his hand like the unyielding maw of a beast. Celendri's twin steel claws turned casually toward him, and he froze.
There now. Hands, hands, hands. They get their owners into such trouble, Master Costa. Celendri and I are two who would know.
Requin turned to the wall behind his desk and slid back a lacquered wood panel, revealing a long, shallow shelf set into the wall. Within were dozens of sealed glass jars, each holding something dark and withered. Dead spiders? No, Locke corrected himself. Human hands, severed, dried, and stored as trophies, with rings still gleaming on many of their curled and desiccated fingers.
Before we proceed to the inevitable, that's what we usually do.
Requin said in a lightly conversational tone.
Right hand, ta-ta. I've got it down to a pretty process. Used to have carpets in here, but the damn blood made for such a mess.
Very prudent of you.
Locke felt a single bead of sweat start its slow slide down his forehead.
I am as awed and chastised as you no doubt hoped. Might I have my hand back?
In its original condition? I doubt it. But answer some questions, and we'll see.
Now, fast fingers work, you say. But forgive me, my attendants are extremely adept at spotting card sharps. I'm sure your attendants mean well. Locke knelt down before the desk, the most comfortable position possible, and smiled. But I can finger-dance a live cat into a standard deck of 56 and slip it back out at leisure. Other players might complain about the noise, but they'd never spot the source.
Set a live cat on my desk, then.
It was a colourful figure of speech. Live cats, unfortunately, aren't in fashion as evening accessories for gentlemen of Tal Varar this season.
Pity, but hardly a surprise. I've had quite a few dead men kneeling where you are now, offering colourful figures of speech and little else.
Locke sighed. Your boys removed my coat and my shoes, and if they'd patted me down any more thoroughly, they would have been fingering my liver. But what's this? He shook out his left sleeve and held up his left hand to show that a deck of cards had somehow fallen into it. Selendri shoved her blades toward Locke's throat, but Requin waved her back with a smile on his face.
He can hardly kill me with a pack of cards, darling. Not bad, Master Costa.
Now, said Locke, let's see. He held his arms straight out to the side, with the deck held firmly upright between his thumb and all four fingers. A twist of the wrist, a flick of his thumb, and the deck was cut. He began to flex and splay his fingers, steadily increasing his tempo until they moved like a spider taking fencing lessons. Cut and shuffle, cut and shuffle. He sliced the deck apart and slid it back together no fewer than a dozen times. Then, with one smooth flourish, he slapped it down on the desk and spread it in a long arc, displacing several of Requin's knick-knacks. "Pick one," said Locke. "Any one you like. Look at it, but don't show it to me." Requin did as instructed. While he peeked at the card he'd drawn, Locke gathered the rest of the deck with a reverse slide across Requin's desktop. He shuffled and cut once more, then split the deck and left half on top of the desk. "Go ahead and place your chosen card atop that half of the deck. Remember it now." When Requin returned the card, Locke slapped the other half of the deck down on top of it. Taking the full deck in his left hand, he did his one-handed cut and shuffle another 5 times. Then he slid the top card from the deck, the 4 of chalices, onto Requin's desk and smiled. "This, Master of the Sinspire, is your card."
"No," said Requin with a smirk.
"Shit!" Locke flicked out the next card from the top, the Sigil of the Sun. "Aha! I knew it was around there somewhere."
"No," said Requin.
"Damn me," said Locke, and he rapidly went through the next half dozen from the top of the deck. 8 of spires? 3 of spires? 3 of chalices? Sigil of the 12 gods? 5 of sabers? Shit! Mistress of Flowers? Requin shook his head for each one. "Huh. Excuse me." Locke set the deck of cards down on Requin's desk, then fumbled at the clasp of his right sleeve with his left hand. After a few seconds, he slid the sleeve back above his elbow and reset the clasp. Suddenly, there was another deck of cards in his left hand. "Let's see. 7 of sabers? 3 of spires? No, we already did that one. 2 of chalices? 6 of chalices. Master of sabers? 3 of flowers? Damn, that deck wasn't so good after all." Locke set the second deck down beside the first on Requin's desk, appearing to scratch an itch near the slender black sash above his breeches, and then held up a third deck of cards. He grinned at Requin and raised his eyebrows. "This trick might work even better if I could have the use of my right hand."
"Why, when you seem to be doing so well without it?"
Locke sighed and flicked the top card from the new deck onto the growing pile atop the desk. 9 of chalices! Look familiar? Requin laughed and shook his head. Locke set the third deck down beside the ones already on Requin's desk, stood up, and conjured another from somewhere in the vicinity of his breeches. But your attendants would, of course, know, said Locke. If I were loaded down with four concealed deck of cards, they being so adept at spotting something like that on a man with no jacket or shoes... Wait, four? I may have miscounted. He produced a fifth deck from somewhere within his silk tunic, which joined the little tower of cards perched ever more precariously on the edge of the desk. Surely I couldn't have hidden five decks of cards from your guards, Master Requin. Five would be quite ridiculous. Yet there they are, though I'm afraid that's as good as it gets. To conjure more, I would have to begin producing them from somewhere disagreeable. And I'm sorry to say I don't seem to have the card you took. But wait, I do know where it might be found. He reached across Requin's desk, nudged the wine bottle at its base, and seemed to pluck a face-down card from underneath it. "Your card," he said, twirling it in the fingers of his left hand. "Ten of sabres." "Well," laughed Requin, showing a wide arc of yellowing teeth below the fire-orange circles of his optics. "Very fine, very fine. And one-handed, too. But even if I grant that you could perform such tricks continuously in front of my attendants and my other guests, you and Master de Ferre have spent a great deal of time at games that are more rigorously controlled than the open card tables. I can tell you how we beat those, too. Simply free me." "Why relinquish a clear advantage?" "Then trade it to gain another." "Free my right hand," said Locke, mustering every last bit of passionate sincerity he could pour into his words, "and I shall tell you exactly why you must never again trust the security of your sinspire as it stands." Requin stared down at him, laced his gloved fingers together, and finally nodded to Selendri. She withdrew her blades, though she kept them pointed at Locke, and pressed a switch behind the desk. Locke was suddenly free to stumble back to his feet, rubbing his right wrist. "Most kind," said Locke, with a breeziness that was pure conjuring. "Now, yes, we have played at quite a bit more than the open tables, but which games have we scrupulously avoided? Reds and blacks, count to 20, fair maiden's wish. All the games in which a guest plays against the sinspire rather than against another guest. Games mathematically contrived to give the house a substantial edge."
"Hard to make a profit otherwise, Master Costa."
"Yes, and useless for the purposes of a cheat like myself. I need flesh and blood to fool. I don't care how much clockwork and how many attendants you throw in. In a game between guests, larceny always finds a way, sure as water pushes through a ship's seams."
"More bold speech," said Requin. "I admire glibness in the doomed, Master Costa. But you and I both know that there is no way to cheat at, say, carousel hazard, barring four-way complicity between the participants, which would render the game absolutely pointless."
"True, there is no way to cheat the carousel or the cards, at least not here in your spire. But when one cannot cheat the game, one must cheat the players. Do you know what Bella Paranella is?"
"A soporific, expensive alchemy."
"Yes, colourless, tasteless, and doubly effective when taken with liquor. Jerome and I were dusting our fingers with it before we handled our cards during each hand last night. Madame Corvalur has a well-known habit of eating and licking her fingers while playing. Sooner or later she was bound to take in enough of the drug to pass out."
"Well," Requin looked genuinely taken aback, "Selendri, do you know anything about this?"
"I can vouch for Corvalur's habits, at least," she whispered.
It seemed to be her preferred method of irritating her opponents.
That it did, said Locke. It was quite a pleasure to see her do herself in.
I'll grant your story is remotely plausible, said Requin. I had been curious about Ismila's strange incapacity.
Indeed, the woman's built like an elderglass boathouse. Jerome and I had more empty vials than her side did. What she'd had wouldn't have gotten her eyelashes alone drunk, if not for the powder.
Perhaps. But let's discuss other games. What of blind alliances?
A game of blind alliances was played at a circular table with tall, specially designed barriers before each player's hands, so that everyone but the person directly across from them, their partner, could see at least some of their cards. Each silent participant set his or her right foot atop the left foot of the person on their right, all around the table, so no player could tap signals to a partner below the table. Partners, therefore, had to play by instinct and desperate inference, cut off from each other's sight, voice, and touch. A child's stratagem. Jerome and I had special boots constructed, with iron-shod toes beneath the leather. We could slide our feet carefully out the backs of them, and the iron would continue to provide the sensation of a full boot to the person beside us. We could tap entire books to one another with the code we've got. Have you ever known anyone to dominate that game as thoroughly as we did?
You can't be serious.
I can show you the boots.
Well, you did seem to have an extraordinary run of luck. But what about billiards? You scored a rather famous victory against Lord Landreval. How could you have finessed that? My house provides all the balls, the sticks, and the handling.
Yes, so naturally those three things couldn't be fiddled. I paid Lord Landreval's consulting physician 10 solari for insight into his medical complaints. Turns out he's allergic to lemons. Jerome and I rubbed our necks, cheeks, and hands with sliced lemons each night before we played him, and used other oils to mostly cover up the scent. Half an hour in our presence, and he'd be so puffed up he could barely see. I'm not sure he ever realized what the problem was.
You say you won 1,000 solari with a few slices of lemon? Nonsense.
Of course you're right. I asked politely if he'd lend me 1,000 solari, and he offered to let us publicly humiliate him at his favorite game out of the kindness of his heart. How often did Landreval lose before he met Jerome and myself? 1 in 50 games?
Lemons. I'll be damned.
Yes. When you can't cheat the game, you'd best find a means to cheat the player. Given information and preparation, there's not a player in your spire Jerome and I can't dance along like a finger puppet. Hell, someone with my talents who knew enough about me could probably string me right along, too.
It's a good story, Master Costa.
Requin reached across his desk and took a sip of his wine.
I suppose I can charitably believe at least some of what you claim. I suspected that you and your friend were no more merchant speculators than I am, but at my tower you may claim to be a duke or a three-headed dragon, provided you have solid credit. You certainly did before you stepped into my office this evening. Which brings us only to the most important question of all. Why the hell are you telling me this?
I need your attention.
You already had it.
I needed more than that. I needed you to understand my skills and my inclinations.
And now you have that as well, inasmuch as I accept your story. What exactly do you think that gets you?
A chance that what I'm going to say next will actually sink in.
Oh?
I'm not really here to take your guests for a few 1,000 solari here and a few 1,000 solari there, Requin. It's been fun, but it's secondary to my actual goal. Locke spread his hands and smiled apologetically. "I've been hired to break into your vault. Just as soon as I find a way to haul everything in it from right out under your nose." 3. Requin blinked.
"Impossible.
Inevitable.
This isn't legerdemain or lemons we're talking about now, Master Costa. Explain yourself."
"My feet are beginning to hurt," said Locke, "and my throat is somewhat dry." Requin stared at him, then shrugged.
"Cylindri, a chair for Master Costa, and a glass."
Frowning, Cylindri turned and took a finely wrought dark wood chair with a thin leather cushion from its place on the wall. She placed it behind Locke, and he settled into it with a smile on his face. She then bustled about behind him for a few moments and returned with a crystal goblet, which she passed to Requin. He picked up the wine bottle and poured a generous stream of red liquid into the goblet.
"Red liquid?"
Locke blinked, and then relaxed. "Cameleona, the shifting wine, of course. One of the hundreds of Tal Verar's famous alchemical vintages." Requin passed him the goblet, then sat down atop his desk with his arms folded.
"To your health," said Requin. "It needs all the assistance it can get."
Locke took a long sip of the warm wine and allowed himself a few seconds of contemplation. He marveled at the way the taste of apricots transmuted to the sharper flavor of slightly tart apple in mid-swallow. That sip had been worth 20 Volani, if his knowledge of the liquor market was still accurate. He gave a genuinely appreciative nod to Requin, who waved a hand nonchalantly.
"It cannot have escaped your attention, Master Costa, that my vault is the most secure in Tal Verar, the single most redundantly protected space in the entire city, in fact, not excepting the private chambers of the Archon himself."
Requin tugged at the skin-tight leather of his right glove with the fingers of his left hand.
"Or that it is encased within a structure of pristine elderglass, and accessible only through several layers of metallurgical and clockwork artifice that are, if I may be permitted to stroke my own breech-clout, peerless. Or that half the Priori Council regards it so highly that they entrust much of their personal fortunes to it."
"Of course," said Locke, "I congratulate you on a very flattering clientele. But your vault doors are guarded by gears, and gears are shaped by men. What one man locks, another will sooner or later unlock."
"I say again, impossible."
"And I correct you again. Difficult. Difficult and impossible are cousins often mistaken for one another, with very little in common."
"You have more chance of giving birth to a live hippopotamus," said Requin, "than the best thief alive has of making it past the cordon drawn around my vault. But this is silly. We could sit here all night contrasting cock lengths. I say mine is 5 feet long, you say yours is 6, and shoots fire upon command. Let's hurry back to significant conversation. You admit that cheating the mechanisms of my games is out of the question. My vault is the most secure of all mechanisms. Am I therefore the flesh and blood you are presuming to fool?"
"It's possible this conversation represents me giving up that hope."
"What does cheating my guests have to do with plotting entry into my vault?"
"Originally," said Locke, "we gamed merely to blend in and cover our observance of your operations. Time passed, and we made no progress. The cheating was a lark to make the games more interesting."
"My house bores you?"
"Jerome and I are thieves. We've been sharping cards and lifting goods east and west, here to Camor and back again, for years. Spinning carousels with the well healed is only amusing for so long, and we weren't getting far with our job, so we had to stay amused somehow.
Job. Yes, you said you were hired to come here. Elaborate.
My partner and I were sent here as the point men of something very elaborate. Someone out there wants your vault emptied. Not merely penetrated, but pillaged. Plucked and left behind like an empty honeycomb.
Someone?
Someone. I haven't the faintest notion who. Jerome and I are dealt with through fronts. All of our efforts to penetrate them have been in vain. Our employer is as anonymous to us now as he was 2 years ago.
Do you frequently work for anonymous employers, Master Costa?
Only the ones that pay me large piles of good cold metal. And I can assure you, this one has been paying us very well.
Requin sat down behind his desk, removed his optics, and rubbed his eyes with his gloved hands.
What's this new game, Master Costa? Why favor me with all of this?
I tire of our employer. I tire of Jerome's company. I find Tal Varrar much to my taste, and I wish to arrange a new situation for myself.
You wish to turn your coat?
If you must put it that way, yes.
What do you suggest I have to gain from this?
First, a means to work against my current employer. Jerome and I aren't the only agents set against you. Our job is the vault, and nothing else. All the information we gather on your operations is being passed to someone else. They're waiting for us to come up with a means to crack your money box, and then they've got further plans for you.
Go on.
The other benefit would be mutual. I want a job. I'm tired of running from city to city chasing after work. I want to settle in Tal Varrar, find a home, maybe a woman. After I help you deal with my current employer, I want to work for you, here.
As an entertainer, perhaps?
You need a floor boss, Requin. Tell me truly, are you as complacent about your security as you were before I came up your stairs? I know how to cheat every single game that can be cheated here, and if I weren't sharper than your attendants, I'd already be dead. Who better to keep your guests playing fairly?
Your request is logical. Your willingness to shrug off your employer isn't. Don't you fear their retribution?
Not if I can help you put us both beyond it. Identification is the problem. Once identified, any man or woman in the world can be dealt with. You have every gang in Tal Varrar under your thumb, and you have the ear of the Priori. Surely you could make the arrangements if we could come up with names.
And your partner, Master de Ferra?
We've worked well together, said Locke, but we quarrelled not long ago over an intensely personal matter. He believes his insult is forgiven. I assure you it is anything but. I want to be quits with him when our current employer is dealt with. I want him to know before he dies that I've had the best of him. If possible, I'd like to kill him myself. That and the job are my only requests.
What do you think of all this, Selendri?
Some mysteries are better off with their throats slit, she whispered.
You might fear that I'm trying to displace you, said Locke. I assure you, when I said floor boss, I meant floor boss. I don't want your job.
And you could never have it, Master Costa, even if you did want it.
Requin ran his fingers down Selendri's right forearm and squeezed her undamaged hand.
I admire your boldness only to a point.
Forgive me, both of you. I had no intention of presuming too much. Selendri, for what it's worth, I agree with you. In your position, getting rid of me might seem like wisdom. Mysteries are dangerous to people in our profession. I am no longer pleased with the mystery of my employment. I want a more predictable life, What I ask and what I offer are straightforward.
And in return, said Requin, I receive possible insight into an alleged threat against a vault I have enhanced by my own design to be impenetrable.
A few minutes ago, you expressed the same confidence concerning your attendants and their ability to spot card sharps.
Have you penetrated my vault security as thoroughly as you say you've danced around my attendants, Master Costa? Have you penetrated it at all?
All I need is time, said Locke. Give it to me, and a way will make itself plain sooner or later. I'm not giving up because it's too hard. I'm giving up because it pleases me. But don't just take my word on my sincerity. Look into the activities of Jerome and myself. Make inquiries about everything we've been doing in your city for the past 2 years. We have made some progress that might open your eyes.
I shall, said Requin. And in the meantime, what am I to do with you?
Nothing extraordinary, said Locke. Make your inquiries. Keep your eyes on Jerome and myself. Continue to let us play at your spire. I promise to play more fairly, at least for the coming few days. Allow me to think on my plans and gather whatever information I can about my anonymous employer.
Let you walk out of here unscathed? Why not hold you somewhere secure while I exercise my curiosity about your background?
If you take me seriously enough to consider any part of my offer, said Locke, then you must take the possible threat of my employer seriously as well. Any tip-off to them that I've been compromised, and Jerome and I might be cast loose. So much for your opportunity.
So much for your usefulness, you mean. I am to take a great deal on faith from a man offering to betray and kill his business partner.
You hold my purse as surely as your desk held my hand. All the coin I have in Tal Verar I keep here with your sinspire. You may look for my name at any counting house in the city, and you will not find it. I give you that leverage over me willingly.
A man with a grudge, a genuine grudge, might piss on all the white iron in the world for one chance at his real target, Master Costa. I have been that target too many times to forget this.
I am not crass, said Locke, taking back one of his decks of cards from Requin's desktop. He shuffled it a few times without looking at it. Jerome insulted me without good cause. Pay me well and treat me well, and I will never give you any reason for displeasure. Locke whisked the top card off his desk, flipped it, and set it down face up beside the remnants of Requin's dinner. It was the Master of Spires. I deliberately choose to throw in with you, if you'll have me. Place a bet, Master Requin. The odds are favorable. Requin pulled his optics out of his coat pocket and slipped them back on. He seemed to brood over the card. Nothing was said by anyone for some time. Locke sipped quietly from his glass of wine, which had turned pale blue and now tasted of juniper.
"Why," said Requin at last, "all other considerations aside, should I allow you to violate the cardinal rule of my spire on your own initiative and suffer nothing in exchange?"
"Only because I imagine that cheaters are ordinarily discovered by your attendants while other guests are watching," said Locke, attempting to sound as sincere and contrite as possible. "Nobody knows about my confession outside this office. Selendri didn't even tell your attendants why they were hauling me up here." Requin sighed, then drew a gold solari from within his scarlet coat and set it down atop Locke's Master of Spires.
"I shall hold fast with a small wager for now," said Requin. "Do anything unusual or alarming, and you will not survive long enough to reconsider. At the slightest hint that anything you've told me has been a lie, I will have molten glass poured down your throat.
That seems fair.
How much money do you currently have on the ledger here?
Just over 3,000 solari.
2,000 of that is no longer yours. It will remain on the ledger so Master DeFerra doesn't get suspicious. But I'm going to issue instructions that it is not to be released to you. Consider it a reminder that my rules are not to be broken on anyone's recognition but my own.
Ouch. I suppose I should be grateful. I mean, I am. Thank you.
You walk on eggshells with me, Master Costa. Step delicately.
Then I may go, and I may think of myself as in your service?
You may go, and you may consider yourself on my sufferance. We will speak again when I know more about your recent past. Cylindri will accompany you back down to the first floor. Get out of my sight.
With an air of faint disappointment, Cylindri folded the brass fingers of her artificial hand up, until it was whole once again and the blades were hidden. She gestured toward the stairs with that hand, and with the look in her good eye she told him precisely how much patience she had to spare for him if requins should start to wane. 4. Jean Tannon sat reading in a private booth at the Gilded Cloister, a club on the second tier of the Savrola, just a few blocks down from the Villa Candessa. The cloister was a labyrinth of dark wood enclosures, well padded with leather and quilting, for the benefit of diners wishing an unusual degree of solitude. The waitstaff, in their leather aprons and drooping red caps, were forbidden to speak, answering all customer requests with either a nod or a shake of the head. Jean's dinner, smoked rock eel in caramel brandy sauce, lay chopped into fragments and scattered like debris from a battle. He was making his way slowly through dessert, a cluster of marzipan dragonflies with crystallized sugar wings that glimmered by the steady glow of the booth's candles. He was absorbed in a leather-bound copy of Lucarno's Tragedy of the 10 Honest Turncoats, and he didn't notice Locke until the smaller man was already seated across from him in the booth.
"Leocanto, you gave me a start. Jerome,"
they both spoke in a near whisper.
"You really were nervous, weren't you? Nose buried in a book to keep you from going mad. Some things never change."
"I wasn't nervous. I was merely reasonably concerned."
"You needn't have been. Is it done, then? Am I successfully betrayed?"
"Quite betrayed. Absolutely sold out. A dead man walking."
"Wonderful. And his attitude?"
"Guarded. Ideal, I'd say. Had he been too enthusiastic, I would be worried. And had he not been enthusiastic at all, well..."
Locke mimicked, shoving a knife into his chest and wiggling it several times.
"Is this smoked eel?"
"Help yourself. It's stuffed with apricots and soft yellow onions. Not entirely to my taste."
Locke took up Jean's fork and helped himself to a few bites of the eel. He was more partial to the stuffing than Jean had been.
"We're going to lose 2/3 of my account, it seems," he said after making some progress on the dish. "A tax on cheating to remind me not to presume too much on Requin's patience."
"Well, it's not as though we expected to get out of the city with the money in those accounts. Might have been nice to have it for a few more weeks, at least."
"True. But I think the alternative would have been desktop surgery, whether I needed a hand amputated or not. What are you reading?"
Jean showed him the title, and Locke feigned choking.
"Lucarno? Why is it always Lucarno? You drag him everywhere we go. His damn romances. Your brains will go soft with that mush. You'll end up more fit for tending flower gardens than for running confidence games."
"Well," said Jean, "I shall be sure to criticize your reading habits, Master Costa, should I ever see you develop any."
"I've read quite a bit."
"History and biography,
mostly what Chains prescribed for you. What could possibly be wrong with those subjects? As for history, we are living in its ruins. And as for biographies, we are living with the consequences of all the decisions ever made in them. I tend not to read them for pleasure. It's not unlike carefully scrutinizing the map when one has already reached the destination. But romances aren't real, and surely never were. Doesn't that take away some of the savor? What an interesting choice of words. Not real and never were. Could there be any more appropriate literature for men of our profession? Why are you always so averse to fiction when we've made it our meal ticket? I live in the real world, said Locke, and my methods are of the real world. They are, just as you say, a profession, a practicality, not some romantic whim. Jean set the book down before him and tapped its cover. This is where we're headed, Thorn. Or at least you are. Look for us in history books, and you'll find us in the margins. Look for us in legends, and you might just find us celebrated. Exaggerated, you mean? Lied about, trumped up, or stamped down? The truth of anything we do will die with us, and nobody else will ever have a bloody clue. Better that than obscurity. I recall you once had quite a taste for drama. For plays, if nothing else. Yes. Locke folded his hands on the table and lowered his voice even further. And you know what happened to it. Forgive me, said Jean with a sigh. I should have known better than to bring up that particular red-headed subject once again. A waiter appeared at the entrance to the little booth, looking attentively at Locke. Oh, no, said Locke, and set Jean's fork back on the eel plate. Nothing for me, I'm afraid. I'm just here waiting for my friend to finish his little candy wasps. Dragonflies. Jean popped the last one into his mouth, swallowed it nearly whole, and tucked his book away within his coat. Give over the bill, and I'll settle up with you. The waiter nodded, cleared away the used dishes, and left a scrap of paper pinned to a small wooden tablet. Well, said Locke as Jean counted copper coins from his purse, we've no responsibilities for the rest of the evening. Requin is no doubt setting eyes on us as we speak. I think a night or two of light relaxation would be in order to avoid upsetting him. Great, said Jean. Why don't we wander around a bit, and maybe catch a boat over to the Emerald Galleries? They've got coffee houses there, and music. Would it be in character for Leo and Jerome to get a bit tipsy and chase tavern dancers? Jerome can murder as much ale as he likes and bother tavern dancers until the sun chases us home to bed. Leo will sit and watch the festivities. Maybe play Spot the Shadow with Requin's people? Maybe. Damn, I wish we had Bug to lurk on a few rooftops for us. We could use a pair of top eyes. There's not a trustworthy one in this damned city. I wish we still had Bug, period, said Jean with a sigh. They made their way to the foyer of the club, chatting quietly of imaginary business between Masters Costa and De Ferra, batting little improvisations back and forth for the sake of any prying ears. It was just after midnight when they stepped out into the familiar quiet order and high walls of the Savrola. The place was artificially clean. No knackers here, no blood in the alleys, no piss in the gutters. The grey brick streets were well lit by silvery lanterns in swaying iron frames. The whole district seemed framed in bright moonlight, though the sky tonight was occluded by a high ceiling of dark clouds. The woman was waiting for them in the shadows on Locke's left. She matched pace with him as he and Jean moved down the street. One of Locke's sleeve stilettos fell into the palm of his hand before he could control the reflex, but she stayed a full yard away, with her hands folded behind her back. She was youngish, short and slender, with dark hair pulled back into a long tail. She wore a vaguely fashionable dark coat and a four-cornered hat with a long grey silk scarf that trailed behind her like a ship's pennant as she walked.
"Leocanto Costa," she said in a pleasant, even voice, "I know you and your friend are armed. Let's not be difficult."
"I beg your pardon, madam?"
"Move that blade in your hand, and it's a shaft through the neck for you. Tell your friend to keep his hatchets under his coat. Let's just keep walking."
Jean began to move his left hand beneath his coat. Locke caught him with his right hand and swiftly shook his head. They were not alone on the street. People hurried here and there on business or pleasure, but some of them were staring at him and Jean. Some of them were standing in alleys and shadows, wearing unseasonably heavy cloaks, unmoving.
"Shit,"
Jean muttered. "Rooftops." Locke glanced up briefly. Across the street, atop the 3- and 4-story stone buildings, he could see the silhouettes of at least 2 men moving slowly along with them, carrying thin, curved objects in their hands. Longbows.
"You appear to have us at a disadvantage, madam," said Locke, slipping his stiletto into a coat pocket and showing her his empty hand. "To what do we owe the pleasure of your attention?"
"Someone wants to have a conversation with you."
"Clearly they knew where to find us. Why not simply join us for dinner?"
"Conversation should be private, don't you think?"
"Did a man in a rather tall tower send you?"
She smiled, but said nothing. A moment later, she gestured ahead of them. "At the next corner, take a left. You'll see an open door, first building on your right. Go there. Follow directions."
Sure enough, the promised open door was waiting just past the next crossroads, a rectangle of yellow light casting a pale twin across the ground. The woman went in first. Locke, conscious of the presence of at least 4 or 5 nearby lurkers in addition to the rooftop archers, sighed and passed Jean a quick hand signal. "Easy, easy." The place looked like a shop, disused but otherwise in good repair. There were 6 more people inside the room, men and women in silver-banded leather doublets with their backs up against the walls. 4 of them held loaded crossbows, which neatly quashed any thoughts of resistance Locke might have been teasing around inside his head. Even Jean couldn't balance those odds. One of the crossbowmen quietly closed the door, and the woman who'd led Locke and Jean in turned. The front of her coat fell open, and Locke could see that she too was wearing reinforced leather armor. She held out her hands.
"Weapons," she said, politely but firmly. "Smartly now."
When Locke and Jean glanced at each other, she laughed.
"Don't be dense, gentlemen. If we wanted you dead, you'd already be pinned to the wall. I'll take good care of your property for you."
Slowly, resignedly, Locke shook his 2 stilettos out of his coat, and Jean followed suit with his matched pair of hatchets and no fewer than 3 daggers of his own.
"I do like men who travel prepared," said the woman.
She passed their weapons to one of the men behind her and drew 2 lightweight cloth hoods out of her coat. She tossed 1 to Locke and 1 to Jean.
"On over your heads, please. Then we can get on with our business."
"Why?" Jean sniffed at his hood suspiciously, and Locke followed suit. The cloth seemed to be clean.
"For your own protection. Do you really want your faces out in the open if we drag you through the streets under guard?"
"I suppose not," said Locke. Frowning, he slipped the hood on and found that it put him in total darkness. There was a sound of footsteps and the swirl of moving coats. Strong hands seized Locke's arms and forced them together behind his back. A moment later, he felt something being woven tightly around his wrists. There was a louder tumult and a number of irritated grunts from beside him. Presumably, they had ganged up on Jean in heavy numbers.
"There,"
came the voice of the woman, now behind Locke.
"Now step lively. Don't worry about falling over. You'll be assisted."
By assisted, she clearly meant that they'd be seized and carried along by the arms. Locke felt hands close around his biceps, and he cleared his throat. Where are we going?
For a boat ride, Master Costa, said the woman. Don't ask any more questions, because I won't answer them. Let's be on our way.
There was a creak as the door was thrown open once again, and a brief whirling sensation as he was pushed around and reoriented by the people holding him. Then they were moving back out into the muggy Verari night, and Locke could feel heavy beads of sweat begin to slide their ticklish paths down his forehead. Reminiscence. Best Laid Plans. 1.
Shit!
Said Locke, as the deck of cards exploded outward from his sore left hand. Jean flinched back from the blizzard of paper that fluttered around the compartment of the carriage.
Try again, said Jean. Perhaps the 18th time's the charm.
I used to be so damned good at this one-handed shuffle. Locke began plucking up cards and reorganizing them into a neat pile. I bet I could do it better than Carlo and Galdo, even. Damn, my hand aches!
Well, I know I pushed you to exercise, said Jean, but you were a little out of practice even before you got hurt. Give it time.
A hard rain was falling around the jouncing black luxury carriage as it threaded its way along the old Therin Throne Road, through the foothills just east of the Tal Verar coast. A hunched middle-aged woman worked the reins of the six-horse team from her open box atop the cabin, with the cowl of her oil cloak pulled forward to protect the smouldering bowl of her pipe. Two outrider guards huddled in misery on the rear footboard, secured by wide leather straps around their waists. Jean was peering over a sheaf of notes, flipping parchment pages back and forth, muttering to himself. The rain was beating hard against the right side of the closed cabin, but they were able to keep the left-hand window open, with its mesh screens and leather shutters drawn back to admit muggy air that smelled of manured fields and salt marshes. A little yellow alchemical globe on the padded seat beside Jean provided reading light. They were 2 weeks out from Velverazzo, a good 100 miles to the northwest, and well past the need to paint themselves up with apple mash to move freely.
"Here's what all my sources say," said Jean when Locke had finished recovering all of his cards. "Requin's somewhere in his 40s. Native Verari, but he speaks a bit of Vadran, and supposedly he's a genius at Throne Therin. He's an art collector, mad about the painters and sculptors from the very last years of the Empire. Nobody knows what he did prior to 20 years ago. Apparently he won the Sinspire on a bet and threw the previous owner out a window.
And he's tight with a priori?
Most of them, it seems.
Any idea how much he keeps in his vaults?
Conservative estimate, said Jean. At least enough to pay out any debts the house might incur. He could never allow himself to be embarrassed in that respect. So let's say 50,000 solari at least, plus his personal fortune, plus the combined goods and fortunes of a great many people. He doesn't pay interest like the best counting houses, but he doesn't keep transaction ledgers for the taxmen either. Supposedly, he has one book, hidden gods know where, amended only by his own hand. This is mostly hearsay, of course.
That 50,000 doesn't cover anything but the house's operating funds, right? So how much do you presume the total contents of his vault would be worth?
It's pure entrail reading, without the entrails even, but 300,000? 350?
Seems reasonable.
Yes, well, the details on the vault itself are much more solid. Apparently Requin doesn't mind letting some of the facts get out. Thinks it dissuades thieves.
They always do, don't they?
In this case, they may be onto something. Listen, the Sinspire is nearly 60 yards high, one thick elderglass cylinder. You know about those. You tried to jump off one about 2 months ago. Goes down another 100 feet or so into a glass hill. It's got one door at street level, and exactly one door into the vault beneath the tower. One. No secrets, no side entrances. The ground is pristine elderglass,
No tunnelling through it, not in a thousand years.
Mm-hmm.
Requin's got at least 4 attendants on each floor at any given time, plus dozens of table-minders, card dealers and waiters. There's a lounge on the 3rd floor where he keeps more out of sight. So, figure, at a minimum, 50 or 60 loyal workers on duty, with another 20 to 30 he can call out. Lots of nasty brutes, too. He likes to recruit from ex-soldiers, mercenaries, city thieves and such. He gives cushy positions to his right people for jobs well done, and he pays them like he was their doting mother. Plus, there are stories of dealers getting a year's wages in tips from lucky blue bloods in just a night or two. Bribery won't be likely to work on anyone.
Mm-hmm.
He's got 3 layers of vault doors, all of them iron-shod witchwood, 3 or 4 inches thick. Last set of doors is supposedly backed with blackened steel. So even if you had a week to chop through the other 2, you'd never get past the 3rd. All of them have clockwork mechanisms, the best and most expensive Ferrari stuff, private designs from masters of the Artificers Guild. The standing orders are, not one set of doors opens unless he's there himself to see it. He watches every deposit and every withdrawal, opens the doors a couple times per day at most. Behind the 1st set of doors are 4 to 8 guards, in rooms with cots, food and water. They can hold out there for a week under siege.
Mm-hmm.
The inner sets of doors don't open except for a key he keeps around his neck. The outer doors won't open except for a key he always gives to his majordomo. So you'd need them both to get anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And the traps. They're demented, or at least the rumours are. Pressure plates, counterweights, crossbows in the walls and ceilings, contact poisons, sprays of acid, chambers full of venomous serpents or spiders. One fellow even said that there's a chamber before the last door that fills up with a cloud of powdered strangler's orchid petals, and while you're choking to death on that, a bit of twist match falls out and lights the whole mess on fire. So then you burn to a crisp. Insult to injury.
Mm-hmm.
Worst of all, the inner vault is guarded by a live dragon, attended by 50 naked women armed with poisoned spears, each of them sworn to die in Requin's service. All redheads.
You're just making that up, Jean.
I wanted to see if you were listening. But what I'm saying is, I don't care if he's got 1 million solari in there, packed in bags for easy hauling. I'm inclined to the idea that this vault might not be breakable. Not unless you've got 300 soldiers, 6 or 7 wagons, and a team of master clockwork artificers you're not telling me about.
Right.
Do you have 300 soldiers, 6 or 7 wagons, and a team of master clockwork artificers you're not telling me about?
No. I've got you, me, the contents of our coin purses, this carriage, and a deck of cards.
He attempted a complicated manipulation of the cards, and they erupted out of his hand yet again, scattering against the opposite seat.
Fuck me with a poleaxe!
Then if I might persist, Lord of Legerdemain, perhaps there's some other target in Talvarar we might consider.
I'm not sure that'd be wise. Talvarar's got no twit-riddled aristocracy for us to fool around with. The Archon's a military tyrant on a long leash. He can bend the laws as he sees fit, so I'd rather not yank his breech-clout. The Priori Council is all merchants from common stock, and they'll be damned hard to cheat. There's plenty of likely subjects for small-time games, but if we want a big game, Requin's the best one to hit. He's got what we want, right there for the taking.
Yet his vault...
Let me tell you, said Locke, exactly what we're going to do about his vault.
Locke spoke for a few minutes while he put his deck of cards together, outlining the barest details of his scheme. Jean's eyebrows strained upward, attempting to take to the air above his head. So that's that. Now what do you say, Jean?
I'll be damned. That might just work. If...
If?
Are you sure you remember how to work a climbing harness? I'm a bit rusty myself.
We'll have quite a while to practice, won't we?
Hopefully. And we'll need a carpenter. One outside Talvara itself, obviously.
We can go looking into that as well, once we've got a bit of coin back in our pockets.
Jean sighed, and all the banter went out of him like wine from a punctured skin. I suppose that just leaves... Damn.
What?
Well, hell. Are you going to break down on me again? Are you going to stay reliable?
Stay reliable? Jean, you can... Damn it, look for yourself. What have I been doing? Exercising, planning, and apologizing all the damn time. I'm sorry, Jean, I really am. Vel Virazzo was a bad time. I miss Carlo, Galdo, and Bug.
As do I, but...
I know. I let my sorrow get the best of me. It was damned selfish, and I know you must ache like I do. I said some stupid things, but I thought I'd been forgiven. Did I misunderstand?
Locke's voice hardened.
Shall I now understand that forgiveness is something prone to going in and out like the tide?
Now that's hardly fair. Just
what? Am I special, Jean? Am I our only liability? When have I ever doubted your skills? When have I ever treated you like a child? You're not my fucking mother, and you're certainly not Chains. We can't work as partners if you're going to sit in judgment of me like this.
The two of them stared at each other, each trying to muster an attitude of cold indignation, and each failing. The mood within the little cabin turned morose, and Jean turned to stare sullenly out the window for a few moments, while Locke dejectedly shuffled his cards. He attempted another one-handed cut, and neither he nor Jean seemed surprised when a little blizzard of paper chits settled into the seat beside Jean.
"I'm sorry," Locke said as his cards fluttered down. "That was another shitty thing to say. Gods, when did we discover how easy it is to be cruel to one another?"
"You're right," Jean said softly. "I'm not Chains, and I'm certainly not your mother. I shouldn't push you."
"No, you should. You pushed me off that galleon, and you pushed me out of Vel Virazzo. You were right. I behaved terribly, and I can understand if you're still nervous about me. I was so wrapped up in what I'd lost, I forgot what I still had. I'm glad you still worry enough about me to kick my ass when I need it."
Look, I apologize as well. I just...
Damn it, don't interrupt me when I'm feeling virtuously self-critical. I'm ashamed of how I behaved in Vel Virazzo. It was a slight to everything we've been through together. I promise to do better. Does that put you at ease?
Yes. Yes, it does.
Jean began to pick up the scattered cards, and the ghost of a smile appeared on his face. Locke settled back in his seat and rubbed his eyes.
"Gods, we need a target, Jean. We need a game. We need someone to go to work on as a team. Don't you see? It's not just about what we can charm out of Requin. I want it to be us against the world, lively and dangerous, just like it used to be, where there's no room for this sort of second-guessing, you know?
Because we're constantly inches from a horrible bloody death, you mean?"
"Right, the good times." "This plan might take a year," said Jean slowly. "Maybe two. For a game this interesting, I'm willing to spend a year or two. You have any other pressing engagements?"
Jean shook his head, passed the collected cards back to Locke, and went back to his sheaf of notes, a deeply thoughtful expression on his face. Locke slowly traced the outline of the deck of cards with the fingers of his left hand, which felt slightly less useful than a crab claw.
He could feel the still fresh scars itching beneath his cotton tunic, scars so extensive it looked as though most of his left side had been sewn together from rag parts. God damn it, he was ready to be healed now. He was ready to have his old careless agility back. He imagined that he felt like a man of twice his years. He tried another one-handed shuffle, and the deck fell apart in his hands. At least it hadn't shot apart in all directions. Was that improvement? He and Jean were silent for several minutes. Eventually, the carriage rattled around a final small hill, and suddenly Locke was looking across a green checkerboard land, sloping downward to sea cliffs perhaps 5 or 6 miles distant. Specks of grey and white and black dotted the landscape, thickening toward the horizon, where the land side of Tal Verar crowded against the cliff edges. The coastal section of the city seemed pressed down beneath the rain. Great silvery curtains were sweeping past behind it, blotting out the islands of Tal Verar proper. Lightning crackled blue and white in the distance, and soft peals of thunder rolled toward them across the fields.
"We're here," said Locke.
"Landside," said Jean, without looking up. "Might as well find an inn when we get there. We'll be hard-pressed to find a boat to the islands in weather like this. Who shall we be when we get there?"
Jean looked up and chewed his lip before taking the bait of their old game.
"Let's be something other than Camorri for a while. Camorra's brought us nothing good of late."
"Talishani?"
"Seems good to me."
Jean adjusted his voice slightly, adopting the faint but characteristic